What's good, Way of the World? It's your boy, Five Star in Vegas, broadcasting live as always from beautiful Summerlin, Nevada. I've been here with my co-host, the only Sacramento Kings fan that I know. What's good, Spread Story, today?
Man, I'm excited. Week zero, a great way to start our college football season, and NFL is only 8 days away.
Yeah, we're getting close, man. Hey, guys, hit that like button if you're tuned in right now to the Way of the World. Big time show today. Man, so much going on in the sports world. I'm coming off my birthday. Spread had a really good
How did that go? What you guys end up doing?
Oh, man, we just lounged around at Fountain Blue. Great, great hotel in Vegas. That's my new hangout spot. I done the one in Miami for many years, the one on South Beach, but it kind of fell off the last, I'd say, 5-6 years. So now when we travel to Miami, we mostly go to St. Regis and go up to the Bar Harbor side of Miami. So I hadn't been familiar with the Fountain Blue brand in a while. Man, they took really good care of us. They're so nice at that place. And they are so high class, man. They bring in about, I want to say about maybe 1,000 fresh roses every day. You know, so they don't spare any expenses over there. Had a great time there. Poppy Steak, great environment over there. Went and hung out at the Vegas Live. Just had a really good time, man. Shout out to Omnia over at Caesars. My guy Matt Roman took care of us over there, and we had a really good time. Just a really good weekend. Another weekend closer to making more money on this football. Had a really good weekend betting, so that made the birthday a lot better. You know, the pockets as well, with us being able to cash the ones that we cash. Let's jump into 1996 SS Impala and push through the pass spread.
The dogs were howling in week zero. Georgia Tech not only covers the 10.5-point spread, they get the outright win over in Ireland. Let's start there. I know you're not too happy about that quarterback there. However, I know we like the points. I didn't think they were going to win outright. What do you expect for Florida State now? Is this a hiccup in the road? This was overseas. Do they get things on the road, or is this kind of a harbinger for a tough season that the Seminoles are going to have to endure?
They have one of the easiest schedules in football. If you look at their schedule, it is so it's one of the lightest schedules you're going to find. They're not going to have a lot of pushback. What I can say is this. DJ Uiagalelei is who I thought he was. He's still the same guy. He's really inaccurate over 15 yards. He lacks footwork, lacks speed, kind of lumbering, still a problem holding the ball a little bit too long, and most of all, just being very inaccurate, man. I don't see him playing on the next level. As I said earlier to you in private a couple weeks ago, I don't think that he's even the starting quarterback by the end of the season, because I'm sure that Coach Norville has a young guy in there somewhere who's itching to get some run, because, you know, they're right there in that Florida market, a lot of quarterbacks around that area of the world. So, DJ Uiagalelei, he is still the guy that I expected him to be. Great job by Georgia Tech. You know how big I've been on Brent Key over the years. Brent Key is a hell of a coach, man. He has Georgia Tech. Those guys can play, man. And I don't think that this was just like a lucky victory either. I think that Georgia Tech's going to be around in the ACC year-long spread. I don't think this was a fluke at all. They look really, really strong at the positions that matter the most, and that's line on both sides of the ball, running back, receiver, and linebackers. They look really good at all of those positions. Number 44 for them, he's an old-school linebacker, boy. I haven't seen a guy like that, you know, in a while. That's wearing the neck roll and all that stuff there, man. He's an old-school type of middle linebacker, and he came to play. The first drive of the game, I really thought that Florida State was about to get on their roll, man. They go right down the field, mostly running the ball. Toafila has a 28-yard run with, like, really no resistance. Go for a two-point conversion to make that two. But it was very important that Georgia Tech had a really good drive to come back down the field. Solid game by Haynes King. He kind of got saved. We know Haynes King is a good quarterback, but he turns the ball over too much. He had a huge fumble that could have changed the momentum of that game, and one of his offensive linemen hustled back and recovered that. And after that, the Georgia Tech ends up scoring. They have some really good running backs over there, man. I like Jamal Haynes a lot. That kid is tough, has great vision, can really run the ball. Just all around great team effort by Georgia Tech. They made Florida State play their style. That's that scrappy defensive first ball possession. type of game. They're getting a victory from their style. Once again, Brent Key just showing that coaching means a lot in college football. Georgia Tech goes over to Dublin, man, and shocks the college football world.
Yeah, and that was the start to our season. Then your biggest play of the day. I mean, I hear about 3 percenters, 4 percenters. You guys can go watch the tape. My eyes almost jumped out of my head. You said 10%.
10%,
but that was 10% straight to the bank. Yes. Montana State, they barely got the win. That was another money line play that was live as well. But Montana State was able to get the win. But New Mexico, that was an easy cover. And that's our favorite type of cash, right? 5-star, no stress, no blood pressure issues. And you know, it's just, hey, are they going to win this game straight up? But we knew we were going to cash with the points. What did you see in that one?
I had some blood pressure issues, but it was from greed. So
yeah, because I wanted the money line. I didn't.
I wanted the money line too. I had the points, but I wanted the money line as well. Really, this whole weekend was one of the best weekends. If you just like to take the points, you know, everyone with that had points this weekend in week zero, literally were in the game and could have won if they didn't win, you know, like, So the points were never in question in this one or in any of the games that we watched this past weekend. As I predicted, Devon Dampier was the best player on the field. New Mexico was supposed to win that game. Terrible drop in the fourth quarter. It was the last time out the Montana State had, they had the momentum, and Dampier on 3rd and 6 throws a dime to the receiver. I can't remember his name, number 12 in there. He drops the ball, man, and that was a big drop. After he dropped it, I knew the money line was dead because in the second half, especially the fourth quarter, they hadn't stopped Montana State once. Montana State was actually losing 17 points heading to the beginning of the fourth quarter. They have a touchdown with 13 minutes left in the quarter, but what was the backbreaker for New Mexico? They still had control of the game. They were playing Bronco Mendenhall style of ball control. Just they couldn't really run the ball enough to move the chains. They had to pass it, and Dampier was doing his job, but their receiving corps is really weak in New Mexico. So they were letting them down, way too many drop balls. And it was, they pinned them. They were in scoring position, had some penalties, and then a punt instead of taking a field goal. They had missed 2 field goals before that that would have pushed the lead 16 points. They missed those 2 field goals, and after they missed the 2 field goals, the coach is like, okay, this kicker isn't making anything. We're moving the ball, but we're not scoring. Let's punt. They pinned Montana State down with 4 minutes left on the 7-yard line. And on the first play, they led a running back for them, Adam Jones, go 93 yards. And that was the backbreaker that put Montana State back in the game. They were ready just to go on and pack it up and say, hey, we lost to, you know, an FBS school. We're not supposed to win here anyway. We're FCS school. And they gave them back life. And a lot of fights shown by Tommy Football, the quarterback for Montana State, as he drives them down the field, and they steal the victory with 10 seconds left. Was the first time Montana State had led all game. So easy cash right there. As you said, a 10% play. Hopefully you guys caught the whale with me. You guys didn't jank me since we were able to cash big. Now I give you guys some more whale plays out through the season.
Final one from week zero that I want to talk about. Just right up I-80 for me, University of Nevada, Reno. When we did our preview, we weren't too excited about this team. So we see them, they hung in there. SMU got the win, but I mean, the 24.5 was never in doubt. We talked about these teams in the preview. After what you saw in week one, are you changing your expectations for any of these teams, or do you just kind of chalk that up to early season jitters, SMU not really being on the same page, Nevada Reno being excited to start their season? How do you adjust your view of these two teams when you see a 24.5 point favorite barely win?
First game of the season, Nevada's fired up. And as you and I know, Nevada has a pretty good football history. Colin Kaepernick played there. You know, they've had some decent teams.
They support out there.
They support, definitely, man. Yeah. They had some really good runs when Colorado State's current coach was the head coach over there. So, you know, Nevada's our state that produces some football players. So, and then that right there next to you, you know, in Central California, where they can get some players as well. So, not surprised. Jeff Choate is a really good coach. He's the one that rebuilt that Montana State program before deciding to become an assistant coach in the FBS. But now he's back as a head coach, and he's the head coach over in Nevada. And he has those kids scrappy. They play really good defense this game. What I noticed with SMU is Preston Stone, their starting quarterback who was injured at the end of last year. He wasn't sharp, you know, and the guy that I told you to watch for, Harris, who's the backup quarterback, who I said might end up starting before the year, was already in the first quarter. So Lashley was not too happy with the way Stone started the game. He ends up finishing it well. I jumped in live, actually, and took SMU, I think, plus 150 in the fourth quarter when they were down like 7 or something like that, and they end up pulling out the victory at the end. Super big plays from R.J. Maryland. I told you to watch their tight end. He's a big-time player. He had 8 receptions for 162 yards and a touchdown. He's one of those guys that can get to the NFL and be one of those hybrids that can make a difference. He's going to be a tough cover for linebackers and safeties in the NFL. But SMU, I don't take much from it. They're going to have a really tough time this year with their new conference, the Big 12, because if they're going to allow Nevada to hold them to 29 points, then they're going to really probably struggle against some of the more better equipped teams in that league. But also, as I said, it is the first game of the season. We're not going to overreact to it. They come in, they survive, they get the victory. Nevada might have played a little bit over their head, but they did have a veteran quarterback over there in Brendan Lewis. Brendan Lewis has been around for a while in Colorado. He just was behind now Deion Sanderson after Deion came over and took over the program. But he did get some playing time for Colorado in 21. He was their starter. I think that they have a chance of going over whatever their win total was for Nevada. They are a lot better and more talented than people presume they were going to be. All right, Spread, let's jump in that Tesla X and charge it to the present.
Most popular tennis tournament in North America is taking place right now. Let's bring in Miles David and talk about the U.S. Open.
What's good, Waging World? Man, we're so happy to have in a special guest today, man. My guy, Miles David from Tuned Into Tennis. What's good, Miles?
How you doing, Five Star? I'm glad to be in the building with you, man. I'm happy to get into the Waging World and talk some tennis.
Man, we're happy to have you here. This is one of the few people that I can really say is an actual expert at this tennis stuff. You guys know we love tennis on the Waging World. We've been covering it for many years. Spread actually played a little high school tennis. You played a little tennis yourself, right, Miles?
Yeah, I picked it up right before freshman year of high school and played all 4 years and then recreationally afterwards. I don't think I was good enough to go pro anywhere close to it, but, you know, I play.
What was your style? Were you a baseline or serving volley? What was your style?
I'm a lefty, so okay. I like to hit big from the baseline. More like a if Kvitova was black, then that'd be how I was playing.
That's my girl with that sweeping left hand. My daughter's actually left-handed, man, and she's going to start tennis training next year. Actually, she's 2, so she'll be 2 in November. So we got to start at 3. Yep, at 3 years old.
That's early. Yeah, get the racket in her hand.
I'm blessed. I can walk out my door in my neighborhood, and right around the corner is a golf course and a tennis court, Miles. So I already linked up, and I've known the guy who's the instructor for a couple of years. I'll start her there so he can put her into the basics, and then after that, we're gonna try to take her to France. You know, we want to get out there with Serena's old coach and with Coco's old coach, you know?
Yeah, I'm not mad at that. Before you know it, you're going to be at the Brisbane Olympics in 2030 or whenever the next one is.
Yeah, whatever. Hey, we're looking forward to it, man. I always show her all of the matches when I'm betting matches and watching them, man. And she sits there with me and she's locked in. So I think that she's going to like it. I think it's going to be pretty natural, man. Man, we know that you keep up with tennis. We know that it's your first love when it comes to sports. What do you think about the news that's really like shocking the whole tennis world right now with Jannik Sinner being accused of doping it, but he got a slap on the hand. He didn't really, you know, get in too much trouble. What do you think about that? What's your opinion on that?
Man, he got less than a smack on the wrist, really. You know, it's really hard for me to digest the news because it comes right smack dab in the middle of him playing the best tennis of his career. And that's an eyebrow raiser for me. Anytime you see somebody going from, you know, relatively good, it wasn't like Jannik Sinner was far away from the top 10 before this season started. He was a consistent performer getting to the latter end of big tournaments and slams. But to start 2024 off, he wins the Australian Open and goes on this tear for the next couple of months where he barely loses matches. And then come to find out, in that time frame where he's barely losing matches, he tested positive not once but twice for performance-enhancing drug. And we don't know about it until several months after the fact, which is very abnormal for a lot of the really leading tennis stars. I mean, sometimes even the guys ranked 300 or 400 they know off the bat and they're completely sidelined for months, and that wasn't the case for Sinner. So it's a lot of questions swirling around about the process. He's tried to kind of explain how the performance-enhancing drug Clostobal got into his system due to his massage therapist and physio. You know, there are some things that got to really fall in a perfect manner for this story to line up, but it's just the main takeaway is it's hard for me to really digest that in the same season he's gotten to world number one, he's tested positive twice for a performance-enhancing drug. That's just not a good look.
I think that you and I are on the same side, Miles, and we kind of line up with Nick Kyrgios, who's kind of like taking the brunt of all of the criticism because he's the only one that's really pushing back in mainstream media that covers tennis, man. And it's so true. I mean, look at all of the signs, man. The signs never lie when you're in these type of situations. Do you think Jannik Sinner being the number one player in the world, knowing that it's pretty much the big three right now, is pretty much Djokovic, Carlos, and Higgy? Because he does have a lot of fans. I'm a fan of his, especially before this happened. Redhead kid, good looking, everybody knows him. Name like Sinner is so, you know, memorable. How often do you see a redhead Italian in the tennis world? You know, got to deal with Gucci, dating a beautiful woman, the Kalinskaya. So he has it going on. And before Kalinskaya, he had an even more beautiful model, you know. So he's always been that guy. But that lets me know, like, it's no way that a guy in his type of position in life and with the kind of sponsorships that he have, he's going to miss the opportunity to play in the Olympics. Like, that's the number one thing, Miles, that really made me look at him sideways, because the doping testing is completely more stringent in the Olympics.
He only, not only did he miss the Olympics, he missed basically his home tournament, the Italian Open in Rome. And I think he gave a hip or a back injury excuse, which also, if you put that into the pile of things going on to go against him, the actual Clostobal that he used as a performance enhancing drug or that was found in the system is known to kind of, one of the side effects is lower extremity pain. And also it can cause nausea. And if you really rewind at the tail end of 2023, when he really started like elevating his game, there was a whole match where he was vomiting into a bucket. So it's like,
I remember
there's some stuff that just really, if it doesn't make you, you know, look sideways, it's going to at least make you raise an eye. But then he has that whole, you know, nice guy, you know, redhead, like you said, Gucci signed up with him to go for the long haul with him. There are some things that kind of make him digestible as a tennis player amongst the establishment, but I don't know, man. It's just on top of the actual doping, you know, because it's never a good thing for when one of your favorite athletes comes out as testing positive. On top of that, they really tried to cover it up, and they did cover it up until they said he bore no negligence, and now they just released what they found as if, you know what, we're good. He's found no negligence. He can move on and play. That's why Nick Kyrgios and others are like, wait, we didn't know about this. And y'all telling me not only did he test positive twice, y'all didn't tell us when he tested positive twice and he's been playing this whole time. So that's just not a good look.
He's a product of privilege, man. And I don't ever like to use a black and white card, but, you know, we're both from the South. You're in New Orleans. I'm from Houston, Ridgeland, you know, by way of Louisiana. So we know this is just a regular everyday life that, you know, some people are kind of held to different standards, no matter if we want to accept it or not. And I think that the ATP really wants Sinner to do good. You know, they want him to be one of the faces of tennis. Carlos is a little rough still around the edges. He kind of likes to go out. He likes to hang with minorities. He's kind of a different dude. They would much rather see Sinner number one. Let's just put it like that. Yeah. And the thing about, like you said, all of the stuff just adds up to, like, it doesn't make sense to me, you know? And when it doesn't make sense, I got to question it. For another thing that I'm looking at too, Miles, is Darren Cahill. Darren Cahill is his coach. Guess what happened to Simona Halep, who also was coached by Darren Cahill? You know, it's kind of like, I don't know. Now, we know that all of these players borderline on cheating, kind of like how cycling is. They push it as far as they can possibly push it because we're dealing with a really demanding sport in tennis. It's, you know, the type of pressure that these guys put on themselves mentally and physically is unmatched, I think, in sports. So, you know, you want to win. We understand that. But it always troubled me that, one, he's really slight of frame, but somehow he has the strongest forehand. And, you know, in tennis. So that's one thing that made me look at him sideways. And Nick is just really upset because he's kind of a minority in tennis, and they always looked at him no matter what, even though we know he's like Sri Lankan or something. Because he loves hip-hop culture, he's considered like a minority when it comes to tennis, you know? Mm-hmm. And he is really tight with Djokovic, as we know. They've been friends like the last 3-4 years since Nick challenged him in Wimbledon. They got close, and they've been close ever since. Mm-hmm. Really a chess move by Djokovic, you know? He got his best competition at the time out the way because that was a guy who could beat him on hard courts and grass. But now Nick is settled into what I think is best for him, is, and that's doing media stuff, man, because he didn't like practicing. You know, he didn't want to give his life to tennis, and we know you got to give your life to tennis in order to be great. So kudos to Nick for that, but also kudos to Nick for having a strong enough voice to not only be himself. I seen him yesterday. He was doing interviews with the Kobe and the Nipsey hoodie on. Respect for that. You know, represent some of the icons in our culture. He's himself, but he also speaks his mind and tells his truths. And his truths is our truths as well, with the fact that, man, they really went light on Yannick Sinner, and he got a treatment that a lot of us, including Djokovic, wouldn't have got. We saw they treated Djokovic strictly for not accepting the mandates with COVID and, you know, saying I'm not going to put something foreign in my body that I don't know about. So we'll see how this plays out, man. I think Sinner's about to fall off because they booed him at the U.S. Open. I don't think he's one of those guys, Miles, that can deal with being a villain.
Yeah, I don't think a villain story arc is really setting him up for success. But at the same time, if I give him an ounce of credit, he has been playing fairly well throughout this whole saga that we didn't know about, but he knew about. So it's not like his game ever completely fell off the map. He's still number one in the world. He got to the quarters of Wimbledon, semifinals of the French. So throughout all of that, unbeknownst to us, he was still playing at a really high clip, you know? It's just unfortunate that this whole thing is just going to look like an asterisk on the best season of his career, you know? But I know a couple of players that this couldn't have happened to. That's for sure. If they tested positive once, we would have known about it within weeks. Not months. Yeah.
Joker. If Joker tested positive, everybody would be like, gotcha, I knew it.
Yeah.
You know, and Sinner is kind of beloved like the darling Federer were. You know, he's kind of like that nice guy.
He's starting
guy
to get that, yeah.
Yeah, they love him. He's lovable because we know all his boys down. Me being from Houston, I've been dealing with this a long time, man, because the Astros faced the same type of situation where when they were accused of cheating, even though we know everybody in Major League Baseball cheats, with the fact that the New York and L.A. media are the biggest powers when it comes to baseball coverage and baseball media, they were able to push the narrative that went best for them, which was that this team is cheating and beat our beloved teams. And that's kind of what, you know, we're dealing with the tennis. A lot of these guys that cover tennis have a fun spot in their heart for Yannick Sinner, so he's getting a slap on the wrist. We'll see.
And the CEO for the ATP is Italian, not to really put it on there, but I mean, it is another coincidence in this whole case. So
yeah, man, definitely. All right, enough about Sinner. Let's get into what's happening right now, and that's the U.S. Open, man. We got the last Grand Slam of the season. Man, it goes by so fast, doesn't it, man?
Yeah, before you know it, it'll be top of the year, ready for Australia. The tennis world never stops.
Where are the ladies? I know you keep up with WTA like myself. Where are they playing the finals at this year? I know they were having a lot of stuff last year. I think, was it in Dallas last year?
It was in Dallas, Fort Worth 2 years ago, end of 2022. Okay. Last year, they brought it to Cancun, Mexico, and that was even worse of a mess.
That was a mess. Yeah. That's what I was remembering. That was a mess, yeah.
It was terrible conditions. They basically built it overnight on a golf course in Cancun and didn't really have a great turnout. But this year, they've settled in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. I might not be pronouncing that correctly, but they've signed on a consistent deal for the next couple of seasons. So that's going to be the home of the WTA year-end finals for the next couple of seasons. So I guess they found a home. It's just that there's a whole other controversy with it being in Saudi Arabia and their set of government rules and how they treat people. So, yeah.
Yeah, but we know how they go. This is just normal life. Great job by the WTA to go somewhere where they know they have money and going to appreciate the game. Because we know Saudi Arabia, you can say what you want about whatever's going on with how they make their money. We know that every country's, you know, kind of foul for the things they do to allow capitalism to continue. It's just what it is. We can't deal with trying to save the world when it comes to watching tennis matches. We're just trying to watch the tennis match, man. And with that said, I do know the Saudis do a really good job of paying really high prize money.
They sell out the money.
Yeah. So I think that they'll do a good job with that. And where are the men's at this year? Not Turin, right?
Yeah, it's still in Turin, Italy. Okay. It's going to be there for a while. They have an even longer contract for the NITO ATP Finals. They've invested quite a bit in the ATP, so they're going to be there for probably the next 10 years or so like that.
Nice. Well, that's good that now both sides have consistency. Like as I said, we're going into the last Grand Slam of the year. A lot of upsets early. FAA goes down to Mensik. FAA, a lot of people are higher on him than I am. I followed FAA when he was 19, 20. That's when I feel like that was his window to really do something. That's when he was playing the top of his game. It seems like popularity, fame in his country, you know, and these tennis guys don't have to, and ladies don't have to do too much in their countries. A lot of them come from countries that don't have a lot of sports stuff going on. And Canada is one of them where they automatically gravitate to their tennis stars. And he made enough noise where he's, you know, famous in his country and things like mm-hmm. that. But he loses to Jacob Mensik. I'm big on Jacob Mensik. Man, that's one of my favorite young players. I thought after the ATP Next Gen tournament that he was really about to be a big-time star in the game. I really feel he has top 10 talent, but he got injured. Did you get a chance to watch that match?
With Felix and Jakob Mensik? Yeah, I watched the very beginning of it, and Felix came out and broke him. So I was like, oh, okay, we got some momentum, and then it just all went sour after that. I mean, it's never a good look when you're a top 20 seed like Felix is. I think he was 19. So he's a top 20 player in the world. You win 8 games total in your first round match. That's just not going to cut it. So, yeah, even he, after his match, you know, they went to the press and he just said he was basically lost for words. He just couldn't understand where that kind of performance came from, especially against a guy. I think Jakob Mensik retired when they played in Madrid on clay earlier this year. But he had some level of understanding about how his game worked. And if you compare who had the most momentum coming into the tournament, it was Felix. Felix got to the quarters, I believe, of Cincinnati. If it wasn't the quarters, it was the round before that. And Jakob Mensik lost in the qualifying part of that tournament. So it was like eyebrow-raising result because it wasn't just that Felix lost. It's that he was kind of swept off the court. And it's not a good look.
Keep your eyes on Mensik. I really like that kid. I feel if he can stay – his problem is fitness. We don't know if he could ever stay fit enough because after he had that little run where he made it to the finals of one of the –
It was Doha early in the year on hard court.
Doha, yeah. Okay. And that's a Masters, right?
They pay like a Masters, but it's a 250. It's a 250, but it's one of the most lucrative 250s because of where it is in the world. So they give you a pretty decent check to win that 250.
Well, he showed up really well after that, man. He played like 4 straight 3-set matches, grueling matches, and after that, his body just broke down. But when he's right, I like his game a lot, man. I think he has a top 10 game, man. I think he has a bright future if he can figure out some type of way to stay healthy. Lot of upsets, as I said, but especially on the women's side. I don't consider this an upset either, but people did. They said Ryder Cooney losing to Keenan was a big upset by the books, by the Vegas spreads. You know, I'm a sports bettor, so I deal with the spreads and the odds. By the odds, it was a big upset. But if you know tennis like we do, Keenan can play with anybody when she's right.
Yeah. When she's right and ready and really motivated to get up for a match, she can play. I mean, she's a 2020 Australian Open champion, which, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, wasn't that long ago. And Raducanu won the U.S. Open in 2021. So they both have Grand Slam pedigree. It's just honestly what I think won out in that match is the fact that although Sofia Kenin isn't picking up wins at the same clip that she was when she was a Grand Slam champion, top 5 player, she's still going out there and playing the matches. Whereas Raducanu, she really has been kind of ebbing and flowing with how many times she even enters into a tournament. There were two major tournaments she didn't even enter qualifying for. She played Washington, D.C. At the end of July, which was the week of the Olympics tennis event. She got to the quarterfinals there, so she showed some game. It's just that she sat on the sidelines for like the next 2 to 3 weeks, didn't compete. Where Sofia Kenin, maybe she wasn't winning those events. She clearly wasn't, but she was actually competing. And with tennis, the more you compete, the more you kind of get that juice and repetition. Right. If you stay out of it too long and come up against somebody who may have been losing but still is on the court, you're going to end up with what Sofia Kenin produced against Raducanu. I mean, Sofia Kenin won that first set 6-1, and I don't think Sofia Kenin has beaten anybody 6-1 in a set in a while. So that just goes to show the difference of those two players as far as how often they've been competing. And Raducanu, she just hasn't been prioritizing the tournaments like that. She just has not.
Yeah, she has not. But another thing with Keenan, what I will say is she's went through a tough time. I think that COVID did her really bad. I think COVID made her lose her momentum because my co-host, he's a kid that I mentored, Sino Royale, taught him about betting, period, but also put him about sports betting on tennis, about like tennis is the best sport to bet. You got two individuals that you're handicapping, you know, and we both love tennis. And 2018 to 2020, when she won Australia, even through the spring when she got to the finals of the French Open, we bet Keenan every time she hit the court, man, and she was magnificent. I think that COVID just really set her back. Not only was she not, you see, she's not, I'm not going to say she's ugly, you know, like I don't want to say any woman's ugly, believe me, but I'm just put it like this. She's not the most, you know, model looking female. Like how Emma, you can see Raducanu's beautiful girls, very good looking, stands out immediately when you see her, especially with her being from Britain, where she has a really exotic, beautiful look about herself. Keenan, pretty girl, but you know, just simple, regular looking girl. I think
that it's a difference between both of them and like how their market value looks. I think
exactly, you know, that's a better way of saying it. Yeah, that's a better way of saying it. So, but you know what I'm saying. So, Keenan was not used to that type of attention. If you read a story, her mom and dad moved here with $286 from Russia. You know, she was born in Russia, but they were already living in America, and they moved here in, I think, 87 with $286, and then they went and had her back in Russia just so their family could help with the birth, and then they came back to the United States. She's been playing, she was like 5 years old. You know, they say she's always been a little menace. She was one of the best junior players in tennis. So she's never had a life. Now all of a sudden she gets this instant success, and not only does she get the success, it's at the time when COVID hits where it's no tournaments, where now she has all this free time and all this money, all these new guys that she never had access to before looking at her and thinking that she's cute now because of her status in life. I think that's what really set her back. I think that during that time of COVID, she kind of lost herself, had a good time, enjoyed life. And then when she tried to come back in 2021 and get back on, she kind of lost her game. And you know how she is. She has a really, she's a really like competitive girl. She gets mad at herself. She's when she's not hitting her shots because she wants to, she's one of the best plus one players I ever seen when she's right. You know, like that serve, she could put the ball anywhere she wants to with that forehand when she's right. You know, whether it's short, whether it's to the back corner, whatever, she could put power on it. You know, she could drop shot it. And I think when she saw that now, all of a sudden, I can't put this ball wherever I want to, it kind of made her have a mental breakdown. And then she lost belief in herself, you know. And then she left her dad. You know, that's what they always do. They blame the coach. And now her dad's back around. I saw him at the match yesterday and stuff. So what do you think Keenan's chances are in this tournament of rekindling what she used to have? She really looked good against Raducanu. I watched Keenan, and she's been a fade for me maybe since maybe January. I've been fading her, man. I've been betting against her. But I saw her turning a corner in Cleveland. So I was like, Raducanu, just like you said, she don't play enough, man. And then if you think about their careers, let's compare their careers. Keenan, before she won the Australian Open and before she got to the finals of the French Open, she had already won a couple of 500 tournaments. She had showed that she was a top girl, in a, you know, top American girl in tennis. Raducanu just came out of anywhere, nowhere, man. She sucked in every tournament before that. She had a, just like a you know, just a great moment in time where she came from being a qualifier, ended up with an easy finals with her facing Leyla Fernandez, you know. So I think that Raducanu, she, you know, took advantage of the time in her life when it was her time. And now I think that that's why she doesn't play tennis as much. But Keenan, I think, really is a professional tennis player and really loves it and wants to get back to the top. So do you think she has any chance to make any noise at this U.S. Open?
Well, her draw isn't really too kind to her because she has the sixth seed very next up in Jessica Pegula, who's made the quarterfinals here before. She just won the tournament lead up in Canada and then got to the final in Cincinnati. So she has a lot more momentum than Keenan does. I just am interested to see how that matchup goes. Because, you know, there's a different intangible sometimes when you go across the court and look at your compatriot. Sometimes you really, really have a different motivation than if you're playing somebody else. Because you don't want to give your compatriot an edge, especially in the locker room. And you kind of just want that chip on your shoulder like, hey, I'm the better American on the day. But, I mean, Keenan, as far as her story, it really kind of came on thick and fast for her. Because I remember the first really big moment I saw Sophia Keenan was at the 2019 French Open. She upset Serena Williams. And Serena Williams at that point on clay definitely wasn't as much of a factor as she had been in different points of her career. But she did get that win. And then that was French Open 2019. Basically, two more Grand Slams passed, and she's the champion. She won the 2020 Australian Open champion. So although she had laid some of the groundwork and won some 250s or 500, it really went from not zero to hero, but, you know, close to it to get that Grand Slam championship. And then at the top of 2021, when she was kind of defending, I think she got maybe like an infection in her appendix, and she had appendicitis. So she really was set back off the court for some medical issues. So it's just been kind of a one thing after the other with her. But like you said, the game is there. When she is motivated and healthy and like has the reps underneath her belt, I like watching her backhand quite a bit. She can redirect pace. She, you know, she's really competitive out there. She lets you know that she wants it. And I give her a fighting chance in that second round match against Jessica Pegula. Pegula's obviously the favorite with the momentum and being the higher ranked player. But, you know, like I said, that intangible of playing your countrywoman, and especially you're playing your countrywoman at your home slam in New York, it could get tight out there for sure.
Yeah, I like Keenan a lot in that match. It's definitely worth it on a betting point of view. I feel like it's a flip of a coin strictly because they played five times. The last two times Keenan won, you know, they each all five times they played, they went three sets. It's going to be a battle. We know that. As you said, two country women going at it, and they know each other really well, but I don't think Keenan fears Pegula at all, you know. So with that, she's getting 5-1. I know you're not a bet man, but at plus 505, I got to try that. $200 wins $1,000. So I got to try Keenan at that price, man. That's a little bit too much to give Pegula. All right, so we had another upset today with Wimbledon champ Kvitova. She does this every time. She won the French. We didn't see her again until Wimbledon this year. Now she wins Wimbledon and loses to one of the ladies who I don't think is a really good player. Don't get me wrong. Roos hangs around about the 100 spot in tennis. You know, plays a lot of 250s and things like that. But I don't think she has any business beating Kvitova in a Grand Slam. Am I tripping?
No, it definitely is an upset on paper, but it didn't really hit that different for me, or it didn't really kind of make me bring my eyes out of my head on the screen, because Krejcikova hasn't played at all since Wimbledon, and that was early June pre-Olympics. That's like we were mentioning earlier about Sofia Kenin playing more than Raducanu. When you go that length of a time without competing, it's really hard to get back on the court and kind of pick up where you left off, especially if it's a different surface and you got different people putting eyes and expectations on you. Because now, not only is she a French Open champ from 2021, she's a Wimbledon champ this year. So, like, people have different expectations for a two-time Grand Slam champ. And, you know, her opponent, Alina Gabrielda Rusa, yeah, she's one of those players that ebbs and flows outside the top 100. But when I have seen her play, she's consistent. Like, she has very technically sound ground strokes. She doesn't really do anything magnificently well or anything extremely poor. And if you're playing against somebody that is, like, trying to find their footing and not really super confident on the hard courts and has been off the court competitively for a while, you're not really trying to come across somebody that doesn't give you any free points. So I didn't watch too much of that match, but I also wasn't that deeply surprised, because Krejcikova was always kind of a question mark coming in. Although she was a top seed, I didn't really have her going too deep in the tournament, because we hadn't seen her in a month. So
I should have known better too. I didn't even factor that in. I just thought about what I saw with last match. Krejcikova looked pretty good. She shouldn't lose the Roos, just in my opinion. But the thing is, Roos is a try hard. But what I did not factor into my handicap was this. As we've seen before, Krejcikova has shown this year in and year out. After she wins, she likes to have a good time. She won it well. She's been with her man. They've been probably traveling the Riviera, drinking the best wines and enjoying life. There's nothing wrong with that. She earned it. Also, as you know, she probably has, 10 doubles majors, too?
Yeah.
You know, she's won.
quietly, so, she's gonna be in the Hall of Fame. Like, I mean,
if you put a first ballot Hall of Fame.
Yeah. If you put those two singles grand slams, add in the doubles grand slams and the mixed and the gold medal she has in doubles,
that's
a career a lot of people want, you know?
So she just had a bad day today, and I'm really ticked off at it. Because look, man, I had a 5-leg parlay going that paid about $2,000 for every $100. I had like three on it, so it paid like $6,000. And I had Nehemiah layup, 2-0. I had Thomas Martin Echeverry first set against Cirandello. He took care of his business, 6-3. I had Paula Badosa, 2-0 against Townsend. As you know, she's dominated Townsend in the past. I had Mergence, 2-0 against Tom Jonovic. We know she doesn't have her game anymore. She's, been injured. Krejcikova, she killed me. But it's okay. it's okay. We were able to bet those other ones straight as well and still make a good profit. We know that the entire field. You've seen the upsets. You've seen what's been going on with the tournament. Who's your pick to win on the ladies' side? And then after that, give me who's your pick to win on the men's side.
On the ladies' side, given how they looked in their first match and coming off the title in Cincinnati, when I made my bracket round by round, it was hard to not pick Sabalenka. She looks good. She likes these courts. The track record at the U.S. Open has been really, really good for the past couple of years. I mean, 2021 semifinalist, kind of, sort of, should have beaten Fernandez to get into that final. 2022, another semifinal, was up a set against Iga, who went on to win the trophy. 2023, she gets to the final, up a set on Coco Gauff, maybe, sort of, kind of, should have won that one. So it looks like, to me, she likes to go one better each year. And at this point, there's no one better to go up than the championship. Add all of that in, like I said, to her momentum, lifting a title in Cincinnati. Her draw, the first couple of rounds, I mean, it's about as gimme as you can get. So if she's playing well, she's confident, she's really not having too many issues on her serve, and she's swinging big and using all that power, it looks like it's, out of all the ladies, it's hers to lose. Given how she's coming on the court. But I went back to those semifinal losses. She can get really tight in really, really big moments, and because she hits so big, sometimes the balls just really start to spray and the opponent just kind of has to put the ball in court and hope Sabalenka self-destructs. But if she's able to kind of keep that tight, she has a better shot than anybody else right now, I think, of leaving the U.S. Open with that championship trophy.
And that's great that you said that. We're on the same side with that one. I actually took a pre-tournament to win it all. I got it +300. It's down to +200 now, right behind hers. Iga Świątek at +320. At Coco Gauff at +800. Rybakina is at +800. Pagulja is at +900. Osaka, +400. One that I like a lot is Paula Badosa. She's been playing really well.
She has been playing well.
She's been playing, and hard courts is her thing. That's what she likes to play. So, and hopefully Sissy passes left town, and he's if you're betting, hopefully he's gone, because you know how dudes like him are. He's gonna drain her before she can't even win, complaining and crying about what happened to himself. You know, and not even thinking about that this is her moment. Hopefully he just left out of town, man, and went back to Greece or somewhere and got himself together. Because I hate when guys like him come around ladies like that who got an opportunity to do something great and just suck the life out of them with negativity, you know?
Yeah, he's another one that can't get it together. I don't know where Tsitsipas goes in his career,
Him, FAA, they both missed their opportunities. They had a window before Carlos and Senna came along, where the big three were kind of on their last leg, and those guys were like the young boys who had a chance to really do something. Mm-hmm. And I put CFO in that same group as well. They had a really shot at that moment to do something, man, and they kind of let it pass, and now they're into the next group, and Carlos isn't losing, man. Alcaraz isn't, because he's a fighter, man. He knows history, and he understands the moment, man. So especially coming off the Olympics, and that kind of leads us to the ATP. I took him to win the U.S. Open. I think he gets his second U.S. Open. And what is this now? Would it be his fourth or fifth Grand Slam?
That would be his fifth. He has two Wimbledons, a French, and the US Open. 21. He'd be the quickest to five ever in the men's tour. So that's, if he wins this one, he's really on a nice path to some history of his own, for sure.
He's at +170. Who do you like on the men's side?
I picked Alcaraz to lift the title. Okay. He made me a little nervous in that first round match. He dropped a set against a player that just, you know, 9 times out of 10, he really shouldn't be dropping a set against a guy who's only won one ATP tour level match and had never been in a Grand Slam main draw before. So yeah, I still think he has the experience, the firepower, and the ability to connect with the New York crowd. If things get tight or electric in there, he can really benefit from that, because we saw that halfway lead him to the 2022 trophy. So he's the guy with the juice at the moment. His draw isn't the easiest, because I think he would have to go through Sinner. I think he and Sinner are on the same side, so that would be a semifinal match if Sinner even gets there. But I like him. I think he hasn't lost a Grand Slam match since Australia. I mean, winning the French Open, Wimbledon, he's only really lost, like, as far as really elite level tournaments, the biggest loss he's had was the gold medal match against Djokovic. And I mean, you know, he took that loss pretty hard, but if you're going to lose a gold medal match to anybody, it's going to be Djokovic, you know? So Djokovic really wanted that one. So he shouldn't be really looking too hard at some of his losses, or one of his losses before the US Open. He lost to Gael Monfils in Cincinnati, and the court conditions were weird that way, or weird that week, I should say. But all in all, Alcaraz is the guy to beat if he keeps it all together. Sometimes he can really kind of, not quite in the same way as Sabalenka, but Carlos can really kind of feed into that showmanship and entertainer part of playing tennis, which is why we love him. But sometimes you look up and he's dropped some games and missed some easy shots, and it's like, ooh, we need you to be a little tighter if you really want to, you know, conserve your energy. But if he's making smart decisions and playing the aggressive tennis that we know he can, I like him as a champion.
His natural talent is unmatched. And as you said, it's the showmanship that sometimes gets, because it gets so easy. He wants to do something fancy or do something big for the crowd instead of just making a plan. The thing that I noticed about him this season that I liked a lot more than the prior season, it's so weird how the tennis does its point system, you know, because we know he's the best in the world, right? He's number one player in the world, but he's not number one anymore. And last year he was number one, and he wasn't winning as much. But I think what happens with Carlos last year that he's kind of starting to get a little bit better at is he's so good, has so much variety. When it's tight, he doesn't know what to go to. And so now he's trying the drop shot, dropping it, and he's dropping it into the net. And then he's like, oh, well, maybe I need to, you know, go with a plus one. And when he gets to the net, he doesn't know if I want to go power forehand or drop shot, because he loves the drop shot so much he was relying on it too much. And now I'm glad he backed up off of it, because he was getting a lot of his errors strictly from just trying to do too many drop shots at the net, like, because he likes to get his opponents running. If he gets them running and you're running with me, he has the extreme advantage, you know. So, but we both go chalk with that. So that's good to know that Miles and I are on the same side. We both think Alcaraz lifts the title, and we think that Sabalenka lifts the title. Real quickly before we get out of here, Miles, tell the people where we can find you at every week. One of the best shows covering tennis in the world right now.
Yeah, you can find me on all of your social media platforms, YouTube, Instagram, X/Twitter, Facebook, TikTok at Tuned Into Tennis. Or you can type in Miles David. That's Miles with a Y. Type in tennis behind that, and I'm sure to pop up on your Google engine search. I release my podcast round by round during the Grand Slams, and then outside of Grand Slam season, it's more of a bi-weekly type of thing. Also on the Twitter/X platform, I'm always doing pop-up live spaces, talking to people in real time about, you know, matches as they happen, talking about breaking events. And I also do YouTube live streams for live matches, giving you play-by-play and talking through some of the best athletes in the world on the biggest stages. So yeah, Tuned Into Tennis is where you want to be if you are a tennis aficionado and love the sport and watch week in, week out, or if you're trying to learn more about it and, you know, try to get to know some up-and-coming faces. Tuned Into Tennis is where you want to be. I'll take care of you.
Y'all link up with my guy, Miles David. Make sure to follow him on X, one of the best followers you're going to find. This guy knows tennis. I really enjoyed you coming on, and I know it's the first of many, hopefully, of us talking some tennis. Miles, I really appreciate you for coming on. This is The Wagering World.
Great interview, 5-star. Thank you to Miles David for coming on The Wagering World. Now let's continue in the present, and we got more college football to talk about. Five star, yes. The SEC. What is your expectations there in the Southeastern Conference? Another one of these major conferences packed with talent over here in the college football world.
It's a really big conference now. They add two huge names in college football with Texas and Oklahoma expanding the conference to 16 teams. You got Nick Saban. The Godfather retires finally after being the record holder for having the most national championships in the history of college football with 7. Kalen DeBoer, you know how I feel about Kalen DeBoer, Spread. I was a big fan of his at Washington. I think he's a really good coach. He takes over for him at Bama. A couple more changes in the SEC, but overall, it's a really talented conference. There's only a couple teams that I don't really think are going to do much, like Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt has no chance. In his conference, I don't know why they won't just move out the conference, because I know the money's good, but they're going to get beat to death just repeatedly dealing with the type of talent discrepancy that they're going to have in this conference. You got Arkansas. Sam Pittman is their coach. Came in with a really good job. You know, the first year he was there, he did a really good job of kind of bringing Arkansas back into the spotlight, but it didn't last long. Now he's lost K.J. Jefferson. K.J. Jefferson transferred. So he ends up bringing in Taylen Jackson, tall, slim, speedy, dual-threat quarterback from Boise State. So he'll be running Bobby Petrino's offense. We'll see how Arkansas does this year. They have a really tough schedule. They play LSU, Texas, Ole Miss, and Missouri back-to-back-to-back-to-back at the end of the season. So we'll see how the Hogs do. We'll see if Sam Pittman can survive. South Carolina. You got Shane Beamer. He's a really good coach. His dad was a really good coach, Frank Beamer, at Virginia Tech for many years. They're coming off only a 5-win season, but he has shown that South Carolina does have hope of getting back to the Steve Spurrier days when he had South Carolina as a factor in college football. They have Raheem Sanders, who transferred there from Arkansas, really good running back. Most of all, though, they have a new quarterback, Lenore Sellers. And I know it's only a game, but these games are so perfected now and so close to being realistic because of AI. Lenore Sellers is a superstar in the new NCAA game. They think highly of him. 6'3", fast, strong. He's a funny-looking dude. He's the only quarterback we've ever seen. He wears his real glasses on his helmet, so that's going to be something that people are going to always kind of, you know, remember him by. But I think Lenore Sellers has a chance of shocking some people and putting South Carolina over their win total. They got 15 starters coming back, so they're a really, you know, veteran team, kind of like how we saw earlier last week with Georgia Tech. It does matter when these kids have gotten these starts in. And then you go to Florida, Gainesville. It's a long and grueling schedule, man, for Billy Napier. He's on the hot seat, too. He came from Louisiana Lafayette. A lot of promise, but he's really not lived up to the expectations. They have Graham Mertz coming back at quarterback. I know that the Florida faithful are hoping that, similar to Bo Nix, he kind of turns his career around and goes from being a guy who kind of underachieved to a guy that lives up to his potential. But he has a lot of starts on his bit, under his belt. Let's see if Graham Mertz can become the guy that Florida needs him to be. But, man, if you look at their schedule spread, it's the hardest in the country. And they start this weekend in week one with Miami coming to town. They got to win that one. If they don't win that one, it's going to be a long season. Go to Kentucky. Mark Stoops has made Kentucky a solid program now. Really good coach, but almost like Vanderbilt. That shows you how good this Stoops is, that they even contend and are around. Because, you know, how many football players are really going to Kentucky? It's a basketball school more than anything. He did get two transfer quarterbacks, Brock Vandegrift, who was the backup quarterback at Georgia. I've never seen him play, so we don't know what we're going to get from him. And then you have Gavin Wimsett that came over from Rutgers. He was decent, threw too many interceptions, but he can't throw the ball. You know that Kentucky likes to go air raid and spread you out, so we'll see how Kentucky does this year. And then you got Auburn. You know, the War Eagles out there. Hugh Freeze, you know, he's not a big fan of mine. We got into it over Malik Willis. So he's the coach over there. And I just don't think that Hugh Freeze is a good coach. I think he's a really good recruiter. I think he's one of those guys that he's kind of slimy, so he kind of knows, you know, whose pockets to grease to get the right guys over there, as he got a five-star wide receiver now in Cam Coleman, who's going to be a Sunday player. But Peyton Thorne came over there from Michigan State, and I expected more from him. But once again, kind of like what Malik Willis was dealing with, when you're practicing over and over just one read football and the coach is holding up these signs on the sidelines telling you what to do, like how developed are you going to be, you know? So I don't expect too much from Auburn this year, but they are a talented team. Oklahoma comes over and joins the conference this year. They have a chance to be okay this year. Arnold Jackson was the backup at the beginning of the year last year, but was a highly touted quarterback coming in as a freshman. Now he gets the reins by himself with their other quarterback that was there last year moving to Oregon. So I think that Arnold Jackson will be okay. Oh, he's going to always keep some receivers. So they got receivers, they got running backs. If they can beat Tennessee at home and Auburn on the road, which I think they can definitely beat Auburn on the road, during September, they have a chance to hang around a little bit. Don't be surprised if Oklahoma's around, but it might make the playoffs even. Once again, really good coach in Brent Venables who's going to have that defense.
It's weird seeing Oklahoma out of that Big 12, man.
Yeah, it's super weird, right? It was big eight.
To me, they epitomize Big 12 football, right? Just like, we're going to score 55 and we hope you don't score 56. And now they're going to this area where I think a lot of the reasons we like SEC players, especially on the offensive end coming out, they're playing almost NFL caliber defenses down here in the SEC. I mean, it couldn't be any more different. Keep going ahead, and I definitely want to hear your thoughts about your favorite team, LSU, 10-1.
Yeah, I think that they're underestimating LSU. LSU's going to be tough this year. They have to beat USC early, but as we said, we know that for some reason, I don't know why, LSU's never ready to play week one. So let's see if our coach makes the adjustments that he needs to on this time around and, you know, has these guys ready to play in week one. They should be 5-0, though, if they get through USC this weekend in Vegas. When they have Ole Miss coming to LSU. Ole Miss really good this year. They replaced Matt House with Blake Baker, so I know everyone who follows LSU like I do are really happy about that, because Matt House had LSU playing the worst defense we've probably seen them play in 20 years. LSU has always been known for being a dominant defense, and they did not look that part last year. Jaden Daniels was putting up all types of points, him and Malik Nabers, and they just couldn't stop anybody. So this year we see if LSU was able to, you know, slow some people down. They do have Harold Perkins, who is for sure a preseason first-team All-American returning on defense. Offensively, now it's Garrett Nussmeier's job. Him and Jaden Daniels were initially competing for the job together 2 years ago when Jaden first arrived from Tempe and came from, you know, in town to Baton Rouge from Arizona State. Nussmeier, you know, has been a good backup. He's never cried. He's never complained. He's helped Jaden. They've been friends. It was not a bunch of animosity when he didn't get the job. Now it's his team. Let's see, can he lead them? Kid out of Lake Charles with a lot of talent. He's a pocket passer, not much of a scrambler like Jaden was, but what he can do is distribute and get the ball to the weapons that they have. And they have some weapons. They got the transfer C.J. Daniels. Keep an eye on him and remember that name, Spread. I think he goes high in the draft this year as a receiver. This kid was elite at Liberty, and now he's wearing the purple and gold for LSU, and I'm really glad to have him there because I watched him at Liberty. He was unguardable on deep balls. So let's see if he can do that also in the SEC. Cameron Lacy returns. Lacy's a big-time receiver as well, continues the tradition of LSU with potent wide receivers. Jason Taylor's son returns a tight end. He's really good, but they also have a freshman coming in who's going to be a star in the future. Trey Dez Green, remember the name, Spready, 6'7", runs like a 4'4", just an absolutely remarkable athlete. He'll be lining up with LSU as well this year. So I expect big things at 10-1. I definitely would have to try that. Then you got A&M. Mike Elko comes in from Duke to replace Jimbo Fisher. The Aggies, they were hit hard by the portal, man, but they also did some work themselves in the portal. You know, A&M has that money. They went and got the Big Ten sack leader from last year. Nick Scouten. Connor Wegman is back, too. He was hurt last year, the quarterback. So we'll see how Mike Elko does. Big game for them this weekend coming up as they have Notre Dame coming into Aggieland, coming down to the College Station. Tennessee, always good because Josh Heupel is going to put up points. Nick Emelavia becomes their quarterback. Long tradition of great Hawaiian quarterbacks. I think that he's going to be pretty good. Tennessee is always a talented team. You got Missouri, one of their best teams coming back in years with Brady Cook under center. He's going to be an NFL draft pick at quarterback. Luther Burden, super good wide receiver that they have, and Theo Weiss are all coming back for them. So I expect Missouri to put up some points this year. I really like their coach, Drinkwitz, as well. And then you have Alabama. Can Kalen DeBoer deal with the pressure of coming behind the GOAT? You know, I think he's cut out for the job. I think he has the type of temperament where he's not going to be listening much to what the people are saying. But how do the locals accept him? Does he have the same type of issues that LSU's coach had, you know, coming over from Notre Dame at first? Where, like, you wonder if the people accept him. But, hey, a lot of people forget it. Nick Saban just has been in Alabama so long, you forget he's a Midwestern guy from Michigan State as well. You know, he's a Michigan guy. So, Kalen DeBoer, I think he'll do good. He got Jalen Milroe coming back. Jalen Milroe's a kid out of Katy, Texas, right outside of Houston. Last year, he played really well. He didn't show an affinity for being able to throw the ball really well. Let's see if he picks up his passing now that he's with Kalen DeBoer. We saw what type of job that he did with Washington in that passing game last year. So we know he's a great play designer. Can Jalen Milroe hit those weapons that he's going to have on the outside for Alabama? Ole Miss, this is going to be their best team in a long time. Lane Kiffin, this is his chance now with his mentor to dislike them. They say but could not stand Lane Kiffin. They say he cussed out his agent for forcing them to hire him.
Oh, really?
He couldn't stand Lane Kiffin. That's why Kiffin be giving them the blues like he does on X like that. He can't stand him. So now with him gone, with Saban gone, it's Kiffin the face of the coaching in the SEC, you know. And, you know, everyone knows him, knows he's a little rowdy, knows he's a great play caller, great recruiter. Man, they got some players coming back. Jackson Dart, who used to be at USC, who balled out for them last year. Trey Harris is an awesome wide receiver. And most of their defensive personnel returns. And then they got some transfer guys, too, including Juice Wells at wide receiver. So I think Ole Miss is about to have one of their best seasons since Eli Manning was there. And then Texas. Everyone says Texas might win it all this year. For sure, they can attend in the conference. A lot of people say it's going to come down to that game when Georgia travels to Texas, man. Longhorns, really loaded. The roster looked good. They lost Worthy. They lost the other receiver, but as you know, this is Texas. There's plenty of receivers that to replace that. The main thing coming back, Quinn Ewers. I think Quinn Ewers is a really good quarterback. I really comp Quinn Ewers to Jay Cutler. Because just like Cutler, he had that same little mannerism, like he don't give a damn sometimes, like just really carefree, but he can sling it, man. You know, and when he's playing ball, he's one of the best passes in NCAA football. He'll definitely be an NFL prospect, man. You got him coming back running that offense another year. You know that Texas has one of the best offensive minds at their head coach as well. And then Georgia, you know, Georgia's going to be Georgia. Kirby Smart has pretty much made them the new Alabama. You know, they just reload. They haven't lost a regular season game in like three seasons, you know. So even though they didn't make it to the playoffs last season, they very well should have. End up losing to Alabama in the championship game is the only reason they didn't go. And people were kind of a little, you know, SEC tired. So they kind of got jobbed on that. But at the end of the day, Georgia is really, really talented, man. They got a dynamic group of skill guys coming back. They even got Florida's running back, Trevor Etienne. But most important, they got Carson Beck. And people are saying Carson Beck might be the number one pick in this year's NFL draft. Big, tall, 6'4 guy, very accurate, just runs a good pro-style offense. So this is a really tough conference to pick, man. Week in and week out, it might as well be the NFL. We might as well call this baby NFL because they're going to be some really talented players and some really tough games, some great environments in this new SEC with them adding Texas and Oklahoma. I think that my pick would be for value purposes, LSU 10-1, you know, just for value purposes only. But honestly, I really think the Texas wins it this year. I think the Texas upsets Georgia.
I got Texas at 4-1 offshore. That's not a bad value either to get in now. Because if you're right, and you know Georgia's just looking like a powerhouse, you'll still be able to edge out for a profit by getting it at 4-1 right now. So great SEC breakdown there. Are you ready? We got some games tomorrow night. Five Star, are you excited? Official Week 1 kickoff.
Yeah, it's some smaller schools, but it's still college football, you know.
But they're teams that I know that you're familiar with. I mean, Coastal Carolina, I've had them in my queue since we've been networking and doing this thing. You've had a pretty good handle on the Chanticleers. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
That's right. The
Chanticleers. Yeah. The Chanticleers travel to take on Jacksonville State. Jacksonville State laying 2.5 at home. Total 54. Are we getting involved in this one, or is this a wait and see?
Yeah, you're right, man. We bet a lot of Coastal Carolina over the years. Grayson McCall, though, is gone now. Now he's in Raleigh playing for North Carolina State. So we'll see how he does in the ACC after dominating so long for Coastal Carolina, for the Chanticleers, and winning us a lot of money, especially on like Tuesday nights. We used to bet them all the time during the week. Jacksonville State is a really good team. Always, they're out in Jacksonville, Alabama, not Jacksonville, Florida. And it's Rich Rodriguez's team. And you know, with him coming from West Virginia, he's a spread option guy, like the spread trout, run the ball. This year he's going with Logan Smothers as the quarterback. He was the backup last year, but he got some run. He likes to throw the ball. He came from Nebraska when he came over there. This is his second season with Jacksonville State. Like I said, he got some run behind Zion Webb last year. Mostly came in the pass. I'm interested to see how he does moving forward as the lead guy, you know, is getting every step because he's not that mobile. So it will be a drop back offense. As I told you, you know, no more Grayson McCall with the Chanticleers. You got Ethan Vasco. I don't know much about him, man. 6'3", 220. He was with Kansas, and now he comes to the Chanticleers. Have to do a little bit more research on him. But what I do like is Tim Beck, and that's the head coach for the Chanticleers. With that line saying 3 points, it seems like it's begging you to jump on Jacksonville. Usually if a road team is getting 3 points on the road, that's the book pretty much saying that they would be favored on a neutral site, in my opinion. So with that said, I just got to think the Coastal Carolina can keep it close. I want to make it an official play, though. So let's, you know, once again, we haven't seen these teams play yet. It's just like you all, this will be my first time seeing these guys, because each year is a brand new chapter in the book. You know, you just because a team played one way the following year doesn't mean this year they're going to play as well. I know nothing about their quarterback, but I do know about lines. And it seems to me like +3 is a pretty short line on the road. As I said, I watched Logan Smothers with Jacksonville State. He didn't impress me much like that. So I'm going to have to take the points with Coastal Carolina +3. And we'll see if the Chanticleers can continue their past as being a really team that we like to bet and that has cashed a lot of tickets for us. So let's take Coastal Carolina +3.
All right, Five Star liking Coastal Carolina +3. Next up, North Carolina taking on Minnesota. That game will be played in Minnesota. Minnesota catching 2 at home. Totals 49.5. What are your thoughts here?
Once again, we're in a situation where this is my first time putting eyes on these new teams, but what I do know about both of these squads is their coaches and their philosophies. For North Carolina, you got Mack Brown. Mack Brown's one of those guys that he coaches his coaches. He allows his assistants to do their thing. He allows his OCs to do their thing. They got Max Johnson and Brad Johnson's kid. He's been all around the world and back again. This is about his third or fourth stop. I think he began at LSU, went to A&M for a while. One of those fifth-year seniors. What he does have at his disposal is a great running back in Amarion Hampton. He's going to be an NFL player. Usually, Mac knows how to recruit really good receivers, but what North Carolina hurts at, as always, is they're usually soft in the trenches, man. And I think that that's where Minnesota and P.J. Fleck excel at. They're a real old-school, tough, Big Ten team. He's always going to play that way. They're going to play sound defense. They're going to run the ball and things like that. And this is their first game at home. Now you got a quarterback for them, Max Bromser. I know nothing about. He's from New Hampshire. I hope he can throw. That's all I can say. One of those spots with me, when I don't know much about the teams and haven't seen them play, week one, I'm playing lines. You know, that's the only thing that I could do. And if I see a home Big Ten team against an ACC team catching points, I got to look at the home dog always, because we know one thing about Minnesota that you can count on is they're going to be tough. You know, and we know that North Carolina is going to want to score the ball. I usually like taking tough over fluff. So, with that said, I think that the style that P.J. Fleck coaches is going to end up wearing down North Carolina. And they're at home, once again, as I said. Lamiki Brockerton is a big-time receiver from Minnesota. If they can get him the ball, I expect him to do some things. I just like P.J. Fleck a little bit more than Mac Brown when it comes to coaching. Tough trip on the road. As I said, my first eyes on him, I know that North Carolina does have a veteran quarterback in Max Johnson, but over the years, watching him, he has not impressed me. And I think that if Minnesota can do what it usually does, and that's put quarterbacks on their back, I think they can shake up Max Johnson enough to make him turn over the ball some. So I'll be on Minnesota money line and +3 on this one. I'll make two bets on this one. Minnesota +2.5, and I'll buy it up to 3, and I also take Minnesota +120 at home. I just believe they can row the boat. That's what Minnesota does.
All right, five-star likes the Gophers at home. Well, it's time for the ball and parlay. I know you're worried about this one because we talked about it before we went on, but this was the best, and it was, of course, against my favorite player, so hey, full disclosure here. But this is the best I've seen Naomi Osaka play since she came back. And I'll tell you what, when I did my preview for the U.S. Open, I completely overlooked her. And I think a lot of the tennis world has done the same. And I think that she is playing better with the lack of pressure and the lack of expectations. You know, she hasn't been on center stage for a while. She's kind of been forgotten about. You know, the top dogs are now Iga, Sabalenka, Rybakina, if she could ever get healthy, right? But we don't talk about her amongst these top players anymore. And for a player of her temperament, her sensitivity, I think that flying under the radar will help. Now, her draw is terrible, so I still don't regret my decision not to put anything on her outright. I mean, she played Ostapenko last round. It's dangerous for anyone when she's on. Now she plays a very tough Carolina Muhova, who we know as an all-court player and definitely has the tools to be a top 10 player. However, Naomi Osaka can win the tournament when playing her best, and this is the best that I've seen her play since she came back after her long layoff. So give me Naomi Osaka -2 games in my ball and parlay.
Yeah, I like Osaka too. I'll probably take a money line though at the -150. All right, man. I'm going to go with a two-team parlay for mine for the ladies. Give me Jasmine Paolini at -278. I think she outclasses Pliskova. And let's put her together with Caroline Dolahide. Big victory by Dolahide. She's really good on United States hard courts. Lost a lot of weight. Kudos to her. She got fit the last couple years and is playing a lot better. Really good offensive game. She upsets Danielle Collins. I think she runs through Sarah Arani. I think Arani's a scrappy, try-hard player, but she just doesn't have enough offensive power to stay on the court with Dolahide. So let's go with Caroline Dolahide with a two-legger and put her with my girl, Jasmine Paolini. Pliskova, she made a lot of money when she was the number two and was the top girl in Czechoslovakia, got married, and is really enjoying her life and her money, done some modeling now, and she just isn't a threat anymore like she used to be. She just isn't consistent enough, isn't playing enough tennis, isn't getting enough practice time in, and Paolini is the epitome of a try-hard, but that can really play. She had offensive weapons to her, always great defense, always great court coverage, and now she's one of the top girls on tour. We get at a really lovely number at -278. And as I said, if you put that with Dolahide at -333, you'll get about even money for your play. So that'll be my ball and parlay for the day. Guys, we appreciate you for tuning in. If you're watching right now, hit that like button. Remember, every time that you give us a like, every time that you subscribe, you help us be able to continue to bring you the wagering world. We don't ask for any money. We don't ask for anything. We just come on here and try to give you guys winners because we want to show love and we want to spread sports betting in the proper way to bet sports around the globe, man. This is the wagering world, And we love that you're a part of the way of the world. It's always us versus the machine. We do it for the underground and for the underdogs, man. And we'll be back with you guys on this Friday. So, you know, I guess he'll be back. He'll be back on here, I think, by Friday, man. He has some stuff going on. Anything for the people before we get out of this spread?
No, man, I'm excited. We got a couple great plays for tomorrow. And then we got a great weekend of football to break down on Friday.
Awesome, man. Hey, once again, we want to say thank you to Miles David for giving us his time to come talk some tennis with us. You guys make sure that you go follow him on X. Once again, the show is Tuned In on Tennis. He's one of the best tennis analysts that you're going to find. He doesn't bet like us. He does it for the love. So you can trust his information for sure, man. Hey, guys, as always, I do this for the greatest Houston sports fan that I know, and that's my father, John H. Lindsay. I do.